Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Just one note before you start. This conversation took place late last month when the North Korea summit was still in doubt and before the calamitous G7 meeting in Quebec. That said, Tom Donilon's observations are still very much on point.
And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
Tom Donilon is quite simply one of the smartest people that I know. I recruited him to help guide our debate preparation when Barack Obama was running for president. He ultimately became national security advisor in the Obama administration. He has a long and rich history in both diplomacy and politics. And I sat down with him recently at the University of Chicago, where he was visiting the Institute of Politics, to talk about his career and where in the world we are today. Tom Donilon, my good friend, good to see you again. We spent a lot of good times together, some bad times together. We'll get to some of that, but it's good to see you.
David, nice to be here. Appreciate you doing this.
So the great, I've said this before, especially when I'm talking to friends, the great joy of doing this is that you learn stuff that you never knew before. I vaguely knew about your upbringing in Providence. But I got a richer understanding of it now in St. Michael's Parish, mm-hmm. in Providence.
Right.
Talk a little bit about that, about growing up there and the influences that you had in your life.
Yeah, I grew up, as you said, David, I grew up in Providence, Rhode Island. And St. Michael's Parish at the time was one of the largest parishes, I think, in New England. It was a very traditional place. More 1950s, I think, than 1960s, if you will. A product of the immigrant experience in New England. Where
when did your family come over?
My mother's family came over in the 1920s, mm-hmm. To New England, and my father's family came earlier into Canada and then into Vermont and down to Providence.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a very traditional upbringing there. And again, it was a kind of a social system. A social support system that had been set up by the Catholic Church to support immigrants as they came into the United States. So you were born in the Catholic hospital. I was born in St. Joseph Hospital in Providence, Rhode Island. You went to the Catholic school, St. Michael's School. You participated in sports and the CYO sports leagues. Your social life was in the Catholic Church, and I went to a very large Catholic high school, St. LaSalle Academy, which was run by the Christian Brothers, which had 1,600 urban Catholic mm-hmm. Kids in it. So I was very much part of that experience, and it really was kind of I wasn't in the immigrant experience, but the social system, the infrastructure there was very much in place as a mechanism to support Catholic immigrants into the United States.
So in I could just speak from the Chicago experience, these parishes, and even today, if you ask people like where they're from, they'll name their ward and their parish in many parts of the city. But in the Irish wards and parishes, there were two things that were dominant presences. One was Catholicism and the other was politics. Mm-hmm. Was it the same in Providence?
Very much. And I think that you make a good point. If you met someone at a high school dance or something, and you asked them where they were from, they would say they were from X parish. Mm-hmm. And you would basically have a pretty good demographic summary of who they were and what they were about just by naming the parish.
Yeah.
So you're exactly right. And this is the way the city was divided up.
You know, in this city, because there was we had a large Italian community, a large Eastern European community, obviously large African American community, and Irish names on the ballot always seemed to do well, in part because people saw the Irish as kind of a trusted institution, and the parish priest, and yeah. And so on. Traditionally in Chicago, like people, if their last name was Miller, but their middle name was Flanagan, they'd put their, and they still do put their middle name on the ballot.
Yeah, and of course that wasn't always the case in the United States. That became the case during the late 19th century and the 20th century, where there was a lot of Irish participation in big city politics. It was no different in Providence. The Providence was really divided pretty evenly between Irish sons and daughters of immigrants and Italian sons and daughters, mm-hmm. daughters of immigrants, and a large Portuguese population as well in Rhode Island and Southeast New England generally. Your point about politics at being kind of at the center of activity and conversation is exactly right. My parents were very politically active in
Father Providence. Was on the school board.
My father was on the school board, and my mother was a union organizer and was the president of the Providence School Department Secretaries and Janitors Union, which was an AFSCME union in Providence. So I have memories of really almost every dinner conversation having something to do with politics. And my parents were always going to a meeting. You know, there were a lot of meetings in urban politics. You always had a meeting that night, you know, and they were both quite active. And again, my mother was active in the union and really until her death.
There was also this melding of the two, because you came of age. You were a 5-year-old boy when John F. Kennedy got elected president, which must have had enormous meaning in the community there.
No, very much so. And obviously, the Kennedy family was a.
Far from Massachusetts.
No, it was an iconic family in Rhode Island. Rhode Island, by the way, is still obviously one of the most democratic states in the country, which is the legacy of a number of these things. It's ironic, of course, that by 1980, I was managing a convention where I was leading the incumbent president's defense and fight against Senator Ted Kennedy at Madison Square Garden.
How did that sit with the family?
Mixed, you know, mm-hmm. I think it was mixed.
Yeah. I want to get to that because I was at that convention. It was such an interesting convention. One of your friends in growing up was Tad Devine, who many people now recognize. Tad's been involved in Democratic politics forever and really one of the most talented guys in Democratic politics. He is probably most remembered, at least by a younger generation, for his work with Bernie Sanders. Were you guys sort of aspiring politicians even back then?
Well, we were friends from grade school at St. Michael's Grade School, Grammar School, Elementary School in Providence, Rhode Island. We went to high school together at LaSalle Academy. We've been very close friends since the early 1960s. We had deep interest in politics and talked about it all the time. Tad was much better known, though, in Rhode Island as a star basketball player, mm-hmm. where he was an all-state basketball player for LaSalle Academy in Providence, Rhode Island, which was a prominent athletic powerhouse because of the sheer size of the place with 1,600 boys. So Tad and I have been friends, and we
the sharp elbows are probably useful in politics.
Yeah, and we came into and we worked together closely in the Carter campaign, where I asked Tad to come in to be part of the delegate team in the Carter campaign in 1980.
I want to ask you about that.
But the other person, of course, who was deeply involved in national politics today is someone else who grew up on the same street with me, who is my brother Michael.
Yes, yeah. Who just by way of disclaimers, now a partner in my old firm, AKPD Message and Media, but really, he's an extraordinary guy because he had success both as a pollster and then as a media consultant. That's pretty unusual for people to make that leap from one to the other. Yeah. I remember I met your brother in a campaign in the 80s, and he was the pollster for the campaign.
Yeah, he was the president of Pat Caddell's polling firm for a while, which is a name from the past and Democratic politics. But, you know, David, we grew up in this environment, as I described, kind of this a post-immigrant environment where education was the primary goal of our parents, to see that we succeeded in education, that we could exceed what they were able to accomplish, and it was a time of tremendous social mobility in the United States. You know, even growing up in a place which was not very wealthy, obviously.
Right.
Tad grew up in a housing project. It was not a very wealthy place, but you never had any sense that your possibilities were limited. And that era of social mobility was a very important part, I think, of really one of the great periods in American history, and one that we needed to focus back on now.
You went to Catholic University.
I did.
In Washington, D.C., and did you choose that because you wanted to be in Washington? Were you attracted to being in Washington?
I wanted to be in Washington, and I thought I might become a priest. But was very attracted, obviously, by politics. And I found great mentors at Catholic University. The first class I had on Monday morning, 9 a.m., Politics 101, was taught by a young professor named Norm Ornstein, who has gone on, obviously, to become a quite prominent political scientist and writer and commentator. But he and another professor named Michael Robinson were mentors of mine almost from day one at Catholic University on the political side.
And one of your classmates there went on to some notoriety in politics as well, probably more than one, but the one I'm thinking of is Terry McAuliffe.
Yeah, Terry McAuliffe and I were friends and roommates.
Went
at
on
Catholic
to
University.
Become governor of Virginia, obviously very close to President Clinton and Hillary Clinton over the years. Terry's a pretty ebullient character. Yeah. Was he then?
Yes. There's been no change in his level of energy, right? And his love of people and his love of politics. And we were very lucky. We had great teachers like Norm Ornstein who kind of imbued in us kind of a love of politics. Norm actually also was responsible for my first foreign policy experience. In my senior year, I took an independent study course where I worked at the State Department as an intern working on a publication called The Foreign Relations of the United States. And if you spend a lot of time in libraries working on diplomatic history, you'd recognize these maroon volumes, which is a compilation.
What were they?
It's a documentary history, kind of a document history of American foreign policy. So it's a compilation of the key documents that were important to each era in foreign policy. So the cables, the memos, the memorandums of the files, right? And that was my first experience at the State Department, and it was an office I ended up overseeing many years later.
You also got an internship subsequently at the White House.
Well, I went to work at the White House.
Did you go in as an intern?
I didn't.
Then?
No, I went in as an employee.
Oh, I see.
I started at the White House on June 20th of 1977. As an employee in the Carter administration, working in the Congressional Relations Office.
How did you land that job?
I had some professors, Michael Robinson and Norm Ornstein, who heard that the Carter administration was looking for a young person to come in and work in the Congressional Relations Office, and I was lucky enough to get that job.
So you're a young kid, probably 21, 22.
I was 22 years old. I was President Carter's youngest assistant.
And what kinds of chores did you get at first? Because I know by the end of those 4 years, as you point out, you were running the delegate operation at the convention, trying to protect the president against this challenge from Ted Kennedy. How did you get from A to B?
Yeah, the chores I had are the chores you would expect a 22-year-old to have in the White House, which is I answered mail from members of Congress before the age of the personal computer. Before the age of the cell phone, where you would take a letter, type out a response, bring it to a correspondence pool. It would be typed up, you would proofread it, and you would send it back to the member of Congress. So I did that for a couple of years. And then in 1978, I was asked to take on working on overseeing the 1978 midterm election effort by the White House. And then in 1979, I went over to the campaign to do the delegate operation, and ended up running the delegate operation, which was supposed to be a good learning experience for a young person. It turned out to be a much more complicated experience with the Kennedy challenge.
No kidding. More on that in a second. One thing I wanted to ask you about, I read somewhere that that in the depths of the challenges that President Carter faced, that he wanted to know that his cabinet was loyal to him, and he wanted some research done on which cabinet members had declared their support for him and which had not, and that somehow that research fell to you. Is that a true story?
It's a kind of a true story.
It's a podcast.
Right,
what the hell?
Right, you know, it's a long time ago. Yeah. No, but I was asked, the president was having a meeting at Camp David with the cabinet and wanted research done on what various cabinet officers had done, what their priorities had been, how responsive they had been to White House requests and priorities. And I think ran into Hamilton Jordan, who was then the White House Chief of Staff for President Carter, and another really dear friend and mentor of mine. And I was asked to work that weekend in the files, putting together the research that the president wanted to have the conversation with the cabinet, and I did that. And that was really my first big project for
Hamilton. I think he ended up asking them all for their resignation.
That was later. That was in the summer of 1979. Yeah. That was a whole different episode. That was a very, very famous episode at Camp David where the president had prominent Americans from around the country come up and have these conversations with him about where the country was, and it was culminated in what is the famous what's known as the Malaise speech.
Even though he never used the word Malaise.
Never used the word Malaise, but that was.
But all of this leads up to this race in 1980 because it was a serious challenge. I mean, Ted Kennedy, obviously the legatee of this enormous family history. And, you know, here in Chicago, there was a little bit of drama. You may remember, because Jane Byrne was the mayor of Chicago, had just gotten elected, upset the Democratic machine. She was a little idiosyncratic in her political behavior, had a fundraiser with President Carter here, 11,000 people, and she said, if the convention were tonight, I'd cast my vote for Jimmy Carter. And 2 weeks later, she endorsed Ted Kennedy for president. So, well, the convention wasn't that night.
Yeah. Oh, well, I remember it well. You know, this turned out, because this is a long time ago for me, and well, kind of a different life, but I was 24, 25 years old and running the delegate operation for the incumbent president.
Did Hamilton Jordan ask you to do that?
He did. He hired me on to do that. And I went over and opened up the headquarters with this real estate agent for the reelection campaign in March of 1979. And of course, it was supposed to be a good experience and something that a young, hungry political operative could take on, and it turned out to be one of the great nomination battles in the modern history of the Democratic Party, where Senator Kennedy, going on into the summer of 1979, indicated that he was going to challenge the incumbent president.
Yeah,
and by October or so of 1979, he was well ahead of the incumbent president. He had a big polling lead on President Carter as we headed into the primaries and caucuses. And I was charged with the delegate selection and then the convention. But it really was one of the great and defining political races in the modern history of the Democratic Party. It really was. It had resonance for a long time, David, as you know, about whether you were a Carter person or a Kennedy person.
Given your background and your history, did you have any reservations about it at all, or were you firmly?
I was firmly. You know, he had become president, had become someone I deeply admired, and I knew this, and it turned out to be, I think, true, is that. There was a kind of a rule that the longer it took you to get the nomination, the less likely you were to become elected in the general election. Mm-hmm. And I could see the damage that was going to be done to the
race went beyond the primaries.
It did.
Senator Kennedy's forces went to the convention floor, tried to change in 1980 the convention rules and unbind delegates, because there was a sense he had won a bunch of primaries late, a sense that he had momentum.
One of the great convention floor fights was over unbinding the delegates, right? You know, which is a floor fight that I led as a young person.
I don't know if you remember this, but I was a young reporter on the floor. Mm-hmm. Jane Byrne and a bunch of her folks from Chicago, mm-hmm. like her sanitation commissioner and Ed Verdoliak, her floor leader, and so they fanned out on the floor and basically tried to browbeat the Carter delegates.
Led by Jerry Costantino on the other side.
Yes. The former state treasurer. Yeah. Brawls ensued.
Yeah, it was
literally fist fights in the Illinois delegation over this.
It was one of the most intense fights, again, the Democrats have had in modern history. And it had a lot of elements to it, David. It had challenging an incumbent president. But, you know, President Carter was caught at the edge of a lot of trends in history, right? It really was kind of the moving away from the New Deal coalition, but with a strong challenge to pull it back, right? He in many ways kind of foretold the rise of Bill Clinton in terms of his ideological and policy approach, but it was a very difficult kind of caught on a number of vortexes, including economic challenges, right? Real interest rates were 15 or 16%.
Yeah.
And of course, we had dramatic foreign policy challenges with the hostages having been taken in Iran. A very difficult fight. And again, I think people defined themselves for a long time after that fight as to whether they were a Carter person or a Kennedy person. And the atmosphere on the floor of that convention, it really was an incredible experience for me because you learned that inside an event like that, anything could happen,
yeah.
That you could see momentum change very quickly, right? You know, back and forth. It was really a tremendous experience for me, and we ultimately
kind of
won.
An extraordinary amount of responsibility for a 24-year-old kid.
Yeah, it was. It was a great experience. It has, you know, it calls into question the judgment of the people would hire a 24-year-old or want to run it, but it worked out okay.
You went off to law school.
I did.
Why did you decide to do that?
Because it was the profession that I kind of knew most about growing up in Providence, Rhode Island. During the Carter years, though, a number of things happened. I wanted to point out. I met another great mentor during the Carter administration, who was Warren Christopher, who was
yes.
the Deputy Secretary of State and ended up being my law partner, and then Secretary of State when I was his Chief of Staff. And I met a tremendous number of terrific people as I was a young person, lucky enough to do that during the Carter administration. But I went to law school at the University of Virginia, which is another institution that I love, because, you know, that was what a... That's what a young Irish Catholic person growing up in a place like Providence, Rhode Island did if they wanted to get a graduate degree. You became a doctor, you became a lawyer. And this, of course, was a great dream.
And but you clearly kept your hands in politics. You got involved in Walter Mondale's campaign, who had been vice president under President Carter in 84, his ill-fated campaign against Ronald Reagan. And you were involved in the debate prep.
I did. I started to do debate prep for the first time then. Well, two things. One, you know, I had a couple of specialties. One was convention management, so I managed the convention at Moscone Center in San Francisco in 1984. But also I began to develop a specialty in debate preparation, working with Vice President Mondale, and then working with...
How did that happen?
I'd worked in the campaign, and knew him and knew the people around him well, and I had a lot of political experience by that point, even though I was fairly young, and was asked to take on a piece of it. I didn't run debate preparation. I worked on the debate preparation. Mm-hmm. I ended up running it in 88 and in 92, and of course, in June of 2008, this guy named David Axelrod came by my law office and asked me if I would...
I remember that conversation.
If I would run debate
well.
Preparation for a senator named Barack Obama.
It was one of the best decisions that we made. But so you did those debates. Let's talk a little bit about debates. Those debates were famous because the first debate Vice President Mondale did very well, and President Reagan did not. In fact, when we were preparing for the debates in 2012, when President Obama was running for re-election, ringing in my head was that first Reagan debate and other examples of presidents not doing very well in first debates because they're not used to people being in their grill, you know, whereas the opponent generally has been in primaries and so on. But the second debate, Reagan came back.
He did.
And with one really memorable debate line,
right, yeah.
The question after the first debate was, has he lost it? Has the old man lost it? And there was real concern about whether Reagan, age had, and tragically, we now know maybe this was the beginnings of something. But he challenged Mondale. When he was asked, not challenged, he joked when he was asked about whether he had lost some of his capacities. Yeah. And do you remember what he said?
I do very, very well. I said, I won't hold my opponent's youth and inexperience against him. You know,
there is an element of theater to it, and that Reagan moment was one of those. because with humor he dismissed what was a concern that people had, and that so he used the platform well. In 1980, against President Carter, he came across as a kind of genial and unthreatening, and when people were concerned that maybe he was too hawkish, too extreme.
He won the campaign in that debate. If you look at the data for now, that debate was held a week before the election.
Yeah, and right? It was the only
one debate. October 28th, Cleveland, Ohio, the only debate, huge stakes. President Carr didn't believe that he could actually didn't really believe that he could lose a debate against Governor Reagan, and a lot of the dynamics in the country were moving against President Carter. We talked about the hostage crisis, the economic situation, were kind of leaning against him, but there was a real resistance to Governor Reagan for lots of different reasons, right? His background, whether he was qualified, right. questions about his outlook. Middle of the Cold War,
right?
He was able to push through this kind of threshold of acceptability.
Yeah.
After that debate, people could imagine him as president.
Yes,
and the race broke dramatically, and the floodgates opened up.
Example, by the way, is one reason why candidates are reluctant to schedule debates so close to the election, because it's hard to recover
the next time around. Jim Baker was doing the negotiations for Reagan, and we came in to do the negotiations, and the first thing he said is this: we will not debate any later than 3 weeks before an election, because there was no recovery time. And of course, then that's been kind of a standard negotiating position going forward, kind of the Baker rule.
There's a lot going on so in the world today, so I need to advance the story a little bit here. But in the 90s, you made the transition in a big way into foreign policy. As you mentioned, you became chief of staff for Warren Christopher, who was Bill Clinton's first Secretary of State. That must have been a crash learning experience for you.
It began, though, in the mid-1980s, where when I got out of law school, I had lunch with Warren Christopher, who was the chairman of the law firm of Melody and Myers, where I ended up practicing law for many years. And he asked me what I was going to do. When I graduated from law school, I said I was going to set up a political consulting firm. He said, "Why do you want to do that?" I said, "Because that's what I'm good at. I have a lot of experience. I think I could do very well at it." He said, "Well, I have another idea. Why don't you actually learn something, learn a skill, become a lawyer. You can come to my law firm. And there's a way, I think, for you to participate in politics with the law firm as your base, do interesting things professionally, but come in and out of government, come in and out of public service." That's what he had done.
I have to ask you one thing about Christopher. He's sort of immortalized in a very sort of narrow and probably unfair way, because he was called upon by Vice President Al Gore in the year 2000 to run his recount operation in Florida, and George Bush brought in Jim Baker. Now, Jim Baker is a fundamentally political. I mean, he has great credits as a diplomat, as a Treasury Secretary, but also was one of the great and toughest political consultants, or not consultants, but operatives of our time. He'd run five presidential campaigns and so on. And there was a sense, and Jeff Toobin was here recently, wrote a book about it, that Baker came with a gun, and Warren Christopher was very refined and brought a knife to a gunfight.
Warren Christopher was not fundamentally a political operative,
and that was fundamentally a political.
It was
confrontation.
A political confrontation. I think that's right. He was a kind of a mid-century American type, modest, tough, but very focused, kind of on principle. And he had been he's a diplomat. Mm-hmm. He was a diplomat, searching for kind of common ground in negotiations, representing clients and the United States around the world. So it was a political battle. He was fundamentally not really he's not a political operative.
At the end of it, Al Gore won, lost by, I think, 527 votes, what history will record. How impactful was that election in terms of the history that we're even living today?
I think if anyone kind of moves to the point that, well, we basically in the United States conduct our policies between the 40-yard lines, and maybe these elections don't make that much difference, and maybe electing a president doesn't make that much difference, who's president, that's wrong. And I think history has taught it wrong. It's incredibly consequential in America today. And that was an example of that. There were substantial events during the course of George W. Bush's presidency, including the Iraq War, the financial crisis, 9/11, and other other significant events, which took the country in a very different direction than I think it would have gone under Vice President Gore.
How consequential? I mean, I have my own views on this. I've talked about it here and elsewhere. Was the Iraq War and the decision to go into Iraq on American foreign policy to this day?
Well, it was probably the most consequential decision that the United States had made in the national security area since World War II. In many ways, more consequential because the impact has been more long lasting than Vietnam. Vietnam, obviously, we had many more casualties. 56 or 57,000 Americans lost their lives in Vietnam, and 4,000 to 5,000 lost their lives in the course of the wars in Afghanistan and in Iraq. But the impact on the United States and its place in the world was very dramatic, and we see it. It's caused it's been kind of the root of what's going on in the Middle East. What's going on in the Middle East today? It led to, I think, the rise of Iran as an important challenger in the Middle East. And it was also, David, I think another important point is that at the time that we were quite focused on Iraq and the wars in the Middle East, other things were going on in the world that we should have been more focused on, including the rise of China and the dynamics in Asia.
In 2008, as you mentioned, you joined us. You'd worked with Vice President Biden, and I skipped over a little bit of your history because you served with him on the Senate Judiciary Committee in
closely,
the 80s.
Yes, yeah.
We should take 1 minute on that. You were there for the famous Bork hearings when President Reagan nominated Robert Bork to the Supreme Court,
and
he was rejected by the Senate. A lot of people look back at that as a kind of watershed moment that has cascaded into Merrick Garland not getting a hearing, end of the filibuster, and so on. Talk a little bit about the meaning of those times. You left before the Clarence Thomas.
Yeah.
I don't think you were there then.
I was never formally on the staff. I advised Senator Biden, mm-hmm. And then Chairman Biden, then mm-hmm. on a number of Supreme Court nominations. That was fought, I think, on the merits then. But it did bring in an era where outside lobbying groups and all kinds of other forces kind of come into the nominations process.
And I presume that the end of that sentence is, and maybe not for the best.
Yeah. Well, it's I do think that nomination was considered. I really do believe kind of on the merits of the nomination. But I also believe that the nominations process has become much too politicized, frankly. I think that my general view is that a president should be able to nominate the people that he wants to nominate, and absent some disqualifying element, right? That they that you should allow the president to have his nomination. Now the Supreme Court's different, though, and it's become. Supreme Court itself has become so divided and in some ways politicized that it's become a very hard problem, David, for us to address.
If you were Democrats, let's say theoretically Democrats took over the Senate, I think that's unlikely at this juncture, but if you were Chuck Schumer and the president and there was a vacancy on the Supreme Court in the near term, would you move on that nomination, or are we on this position now where the Merrick Garland rule is going to get extended and the Senate's just not going to or shouldn't move on?
This is kind of outside my area of expertise at this point.
It may be outside your area of comfort, but it's not outside your area of expertise.
Right. I think that the precedent that was set by the Republican Senate on not bringing up Merrick Garland's nomination for the Supreme Court for over a year was a really bad precedent. No one could have been more qualified.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was accepted on both sides of the aisle.
I think that's why they didn't want to put him on the floor for a vote.
He would have been, on the natural, I think he probably would have been a 90-10 confirmation for the Supreme Court, and it was a mistake, and it was a mistake from a lot of perspectives. It was a mistake, I think, for the country, because we don't have his service on the Supreme Court. But the precedent is really damaging for the reasons that you lay out, right? Which is that you can imagine that if Democrats were now in a similar position, they would also hold off on going forward with a nomination.
Let's move forward to your tenure in the Obama administration, first as Deputy National Security Advisor and then as National Security Advisor. You were there for 5 years. There were some really obviously consequential events, the wind down on the war in Iraq. I just want to run through some questions yeah. that are asked, and then I want to talk about where we are today. The decision to draw down the troops in Iraq and leave is one that's often cited by opponents of the Obama foreign policy as a reason that that created a vacuum for ISIS and gave the Iraqi government more leeway to crack down on Sunni and so where do you what do you say?
There's a couple of things about that. Number one, there was not a precipitous drawdown of troops in Iraq by the Obama administration.
But there were none left after 2011.
But it took place. It took place over a period of 3 years. It took place essentially on the timetable that had been put together and agreed to by President Bush 43's administration and the Iraqi government. By the time that December of 2011 came around, there was not a lot of appetite among Iraqi politicians for the continuation of large presence of U.S. troops in Iraq.
So presumably, if the government, if the U.S. insisted that,
well, that's not clear. That's not clear. You know, and our military at that point was very much objected to not having the kinds of immunities given to them by the Iraqi mm-hmm. parliament that they sought. And I also don't think at the end of the day that you can assign the rise of ISIS to that, mm-hmm. you know, to that set of decisions. There were a lot of other dynamics going on in Iraq. Principally, the Maliki government had become sectarian mm-hmm. and authoritarian, and really kind of quite violent against their opposition. Mm-hmm. And you had an uprising that took place. And you have to ask yourself, David, if the United States had had 5 or 10,000 troops in Baghdad, would it have made, what kind of difference would it have made? And I'm not sure at the end of the day, given the overall dynamics that were underway, including the war in Syria, that were underway in 2013 and 2014, whether or not you wouldn't have had the rise of ISIS.
The other issue that comes up is the reset.
Yeah.
Maybe an unfortunate symbol was the reset button.
Yeah.
I had Mike McFaul here recently. And I remember very well that a lot of business was transacted in those first 2 years with Russia when Putin was in the prime minister's spot, still a dominant figure. But Medvedev, the president then, and Obama had a close working relationship, or at least a cooperative relationship.
It was very different. You know, this was a period where kind of the great power relations in the world were generally cooperative and constructive. We were under no illusions what Putin's coming back would mean for this. But during the period that Medvedev was leading Russia, the prime minister of Russia, we did get a lot of things done. And we knew that may be a limited time frame. There was no naivete about this. But during that time frame, of course, we were able to agree with the Russians on allowing lethal support for our effort in Afghanistan. We worked through a number of economic and other issues. We did an important arms control treaty, the New Start treaty. So there were a number of achievements, but it was but we knew at that point it was likely to be a limited amount of time if Putin came back. We were under no illusions about that the attitude of Russia could change with Putin coming back. And indeed, one of the principal trends in the world today is the reemergence of geopolitical competition and conflict, and ideological competition and conflict. And I think you can really date that to Putin's coming back into the presidency of Russia in the spring of 2012.
You were the one who brought the news to President Obama that the CIA thought they might have some inkling as to where Osama bin Laden was hiding. just briefly, how did that evolve? And talk about the decision that President Obama made to move forward on that. What was a risky mission?
Yeah. So this begins in the summer of 2010, when the Central Intelligence Agency indicated to the president that they had the best lead that they thought they had had since he disappeared in the mountains of Tora Bora in the early 2000s as to where Osama bin Laden might be. And we worked on the intelligence community, which had been working on this through two presidencies, worked to develop the intelligence, to pinpoint this in as stark a way or as careful a way as they could during the rest of the year 2010. And by the beginning of 2010, it indicated to the president that this was the best evidence we had been able to develop since he had disappeared. And the president asked us to develop options for addressing the issue, which we did during the first part of 2011, and then in May of 2011,
So all of that time, there were a few people read into this, but yeah, probably just a very few.
Just a few people in the White House, and it was on a strict need to know basis. It was a lesson in how to keep a secret in Washington, which is a simple rule. If you want to keep a secret in Washington, don't tell
anybody.
Apparently
a lesson lost.
Yeah. If you want to keep a secret in Washington, don't tell anybody. All right. And it was really, in all seriousness, something that was held very close. It did not leak. That's a tribute to the people involved. It's a tribute to how serious they took their obligations to the country and the seriousness of the operation that we were about to undertake, because it really was a strategic blow against Al-Qaeda. So the president oversaw this process for 8 months, again, from August or so of 2010 to May of 2011. Now, the decision itself to undertake the raid from Afghanistan into Pakistan to strike the compound at Abbottabad, Pakistan, was based on circumstantial evidence. This was not a direct evidence case. This was an analytical case put together by the intelligence community.
You never had eyes on bin Laden?
No, we didn't. Not that we knew, right? There was not direct evidence. We couldn't go in and say to the president, you know, we were absolutely sure. Here's a picture. Here's another piece of evidence where we can tell you with 100% certainty that Osama bin Laden is at this.
Authorized this raid. He knew was going to create some turmoil with the Pakistani government. Were you in favor of the raid?
Yeah, very much so. But it was a divided room, David. So the president, he has in his national security team some of the most prominent Americans in national security that we have, right? Bob Gates, Joe Biden, Hillary Clinton, Mike Mullen, Leon Panetta, you know. Mm-hmm. It was an extraordinary array of talent and experience in the room. And on the Thursday night before the decision, this has been reported, the president asked people where they stood, and the room was divided. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, of course, we ask our presidents to make those decisions.
What would have happened if bin Laden hadn't been there?
Well, that was part of the basis for the decision the president ultimately made. He had confidence that our special forces, if bin Laden were there, they would deal with it. And if he wasn't there, they would get out. They would get out safely. This is exactly, I think, what tipped the balance. As you know, what tipped the balance here in a circumstantial case was the president's experience with and his confidence in the U.S. Special Forces. The U.S. Special Forces are a unique American asset. There isn't anything like it in the world. There never has been anything like it in the world, as far as I know. And he had every confidence that these teams could go in, and if bin Laden was there, they would deal with it, and either capture or eliminate him. And if he wasn't there, that they would have the ability to go in and get out. Now, he actually made contributions to that decision that were very significant in terms of working through the mechanisms by which the special forces would get in and out. But this was the thing that tipped the decision, right? I think was his absolute confidence in the confidence and judgment of the special forces of the United States.
One of the things that he has said he looks back at with regret was the decision to intervene in Libya. Talk about that and what the implications of that were. You know, he had a pretty well-defined philosophy based on what the lessons of the recent history that you have to think beyond the first step and then about what happens next. We know what happened at the moment that Gaddafi was killed. But after, Libya became kind of an ungovernable space and a haven for ISIS and for terrorism. Was that the right decision?
Well, we step back for a minute, right, on what was going on in the world at that point. The Arab Spring, which came to the forefront in the winter of 2011, it turned out to be negative in almost every respect, right, from the perspective of security in the Middle East and our own security interests in the Middle East. You know, it has its roots in my judgment, decades of failure of governance in the Middle East, vacuums created as a result of that.
At the time, there was great celebration because Americans identify with the aspirations of people who are fighting against those kinds of conditions.
But we have, but the result, of course, in these this vacuum, and it was a communications revolution that I think was important to this. But we basically saw a number of failed states emerge in the wake of the so-called Arab Spring. In Libya, I think what the president has said is not that it was a mistake to act against Gaddafi and his threats against the Libyan people, but rather that the international community, and I think principally the Europeans, were not adequately prepared to deal with the aftermath in the kind of scale and force of intervention that was necessary to keep the country on track. I think that's what he. I think that's.
I didn't
what he said.
Say. I said he looked back at it with regret. I didn't say he looked back at it as a as a mistake. Yeah. I'm not going to ask you about Syria because you were gone by the time that decision was made. And I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about where we are today. You've seen this president make a series of fairly significant decisions, some of which to reverse policies that you helped begin. You were gone by the time the Iran agreement was reached, but that was part of a long
process.
President Obama in his second term, Paris Climate Agreement, he pushed the TPP. That was something that you were involved in, and so on. And then we see North Korea, and as we sit here today, that is very much up in the air because the summit that the president promised with great fanfare is now canceled. Just give me your view of where we are in the world and what your concerns are and whether you see any strengths in what the president's doing.
My concern is this, is that for the last 70 years, we have had an international order created and led by the United States, which has led to, and it hasn't been perfect, but in the main, it has led to extraordinary prosperity and security for the United States. And at the core of that are a set of principles and institutions that we led on. Values that we led on in terms of democracy and free markets, and institutions like international agreements, international institutions like the United Nations, and things like the structures around something like the Paris Accord. But most importantly, the United States in the lead. The alliance structure that the United States put together around the world to support our efforts to, around the world. And each one of these pillars, alliances, trade, liberal economics, democracy, international institutions, and international agreements are all elements of this international order that President Trump has challenged. And in almost each of those cases, pulled back from a much different relationship with allies, a much more transactional relationship with allies. It's called deep concern among our allies around the world and uncertainty about U.S. leadership. On trade, has pulled back pretty dramatically and inserted a tremendous amount of uncertainty in our economic approach. International agreements like the Paris Accord, right? Basically, the president has said that he's not really that interested in multilateral agreements, wants to have bilateral agreements, international institutions generally. And I think the question in the world, David, is if the United States isn't leading on these values, these institutions, these approaches, what's going to replace it? And that's the real challenge. And it comes at a really inopportune time. It comes when we have a resurgence of geopolitical competition among the great powers. It comes when we have really an ideological kind of resurgence of an ideological debate in the world about what system is best and can deliver for people. And for the United States to be pulling back at this point in the ways that President Trump has is deeply worrying. And it's been and it's caused a tremendous amount of instability and volatility around the world. So the question presented is, if you've had 75 years of a U.S.-led order and you pull back all the pillars of that order, the question is, what's going to replace it? And we don't really have an answer to that at this point.
He would say that that the U.S. has given more than it's gotten. That's the core of his argument, that we've been taken advantage of by the world, and that the world's been living on our dime.
Yeah, that's extraordinarily short-sighted and inaccurate historically, of course, because no country in the world, right, has had the level of peace and prosperity that the United States has had at the core of this international order that the United States put together. It's just not correct. And indeed, we benefit tremendously from the levels of stability and prosperity around the world. And what's happened is we pull back, the world doesn't stay static. Mm-hmm. You know, so we pull back from the trade, from the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, right? And the other 11 countries go forward, right? We pull back from our allies in Europe, and they start to talk about and look at moving forward without us. Indeed, you have the Chancellor of Germany saying things like, we can no longer count on the United States to provide for our defense or to lead us as an alliance. These are extraordinary things that are going on in the world. And again, the question is, what replaces it? And what happens in a period of disorder to our interest and our security going forward, coming out of what we led the order. So I think that his analysis is something I wish he would revisit, because it's not correct. Now, a couple of the specific things, you know, I think the pulling out of the Iran agreement is the worst mistake the United States has made in the Middle East since the Iraq War. And it's been at a high cost, including with allies in Europe. And there's nothing that was laid out, for example, in Secretary Pompeo's speech the other day about our goals, the additional things we want to do with Iran. There's nothing that we couldn't have pursued more effectively, multilaterally, while keeping the arrangement in place that really has capped, rolled back, and for an extended period of time, pushed back the Iranian nuclear program. We had that as a base, and we could have worked on follow-on agreements with allies around the world. The key to the Iran agreement, of course, was that it was multilateral. I led the pressure campaign, as you know, for almost 5 years against Iran. The key wasn't U.S. bilateral pressure on Iran. Right. We haven't done any real economic business with Iran since 1979. The key was our ability to talk to the world about the value, the goal, which was not to have a nuclear Iran, pull that together and get an agreement on the pressure campaign. You needed to have multilateral pressure in order to have an effective pressure campaign in Iran. And so it'd be very difficult to reconstruct that now. I think that, you know, the TPP, we talked about at Paris.
Isn't the true view there that if we put enough pressure on, if we continue down the road of sanctions, it you know, leaving aside the fact that the sanctions need to be global to be effective, that somehow we can force regime change there? Isn't that sort of the true objective?
Well, you know, a couple of things. First of all, the sanctions will never be as effective as they were, right? You know, we had the world engaged in a pressure campaign on Iran, including the Chinese and the Russians. All right, mm-hmm. It'll be exceedingly difficult, if not impossible, for us to put together that kind of campaign again. And at some point, if you can't kind of put together that kind of campaign that brought them to the table, if you could be brought to the brink of the what we faced, right, initially, which was a choice between Iran going nuclear and us having to take military action.
Because they'll go back to there.
And us taking military action. You'll be confronted with that choice, which makes military action more likely. There are, I think, a number of people in the Trump administration who do see regime change as the
John Bolton, for one who has your job, your old job,
as a solution, right? And of course, you have to think about what the cost of that would be, our ability to execute on that. And it would seem to me that our experience in the Middle East over the last 15 plus years should have us focus on the real problem, right? The real problem here was a security problem. The real problem was, at least in the first instance, was to cap the nuclear program, which we did and provided an important element of stability. And then we could move to these other issues, which are real issues. By the way, Secretary Pompeo laid out a dozen things that he would like to see Iran do that they're not doing today that cause us issues, right? I agree with every one of them. But we've now foregone the most effective way to address those, I fear. So I think it's at a very high cost, including, as I said earlier, to our European allies and our relationships as well. So I think we've taken the wrong course there, and I think we'll look back at it, and I think we'll see that as the worst mistake since the Iraq War in the Middle East, and I think we'll see pulling out of the TPP as one of the worst mistakes we've made in Asia since Vietnam.
What about this strange back and forth with North Korea, where the president first lurched in the direction of war, calling him the little rocket man, promising fire and fury, then announced that he would hold a summit with him, now backing out, not clear who is actually backing out, but the president sent a letter backing out in recent days. Where's that headed? You grappled with North Korea. It's a very tough situation.
The policy that the United States was pursuing, the maximum pressure policy to bring the North Koreans to the table to address the nuclear program, is the right policy. And I think we should have continued along those lines. Now, we evidently had an opportunity for a face-to-face negotiation and negotiations about the nuclear program, and we were right to try to move in that direction. But this execution of this has been really, I think, off track from the beginning, David. It was entered into impulsively after a briefing from South Korean officials. We then lost message discipline on it, where we had the National Security Advisor, one of my successor, John Bolton, talking about the Libyan model, which is not applicable here, and was guaranteed.
Which really goes
to
the core of
North
what
Koreans.
The North Koreans fear, which is regime change.
Yeah, so it's a, I think the...
Do you think he was trying to scuttle the thing? We know that he has said that he'd prefer a military option.
Yeah, I mean, Ambassador Bolton's had clear views on North Korea for a long time, but I can't look into his mind. I don't like to ascribe motivations to people, but I can just tell you the fact. Right, the fact is that citing the Libya model was not geared to make this a successful negotiation. Okay. Right, it was geared to kind of it was a mistake. To take it off track.
Unless it was intended to be.
Yeah, the right way forward here, I don't think, was to send this letter scuttling the negotiation, the June 12th meeting. I think the right way forward would have been to say the following, and we didn't do this at the front end. We don't have the same understandings, evidently, with respect to what our goals are here. We don't have a common understandings with respect to what denuclearization means. It means something to us in terms of you giving up in a verifiable and irreversible way your nuclear program. To you, it means the phase drawdown and all kinds of other things on North Korea side. We clearly need more work before we get together.
Such
a meeting takes place.
Which is how diplomacy generally works.
Exactly. We have a channel that has been working thus far with Secretary Pompeo. I think the right decision, David, would have been to hold in place the gains that we've had to date and to ask for the meeting to be postponed for Secretary Pompeo and interlocutors, including the leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un, to have further conversations so that we can raise the prospects of success for this meeting.
Where does it go now?
well, I don't know where it goes now. You would want to, you know, you'd want to get it back to a negotiated track, but we'll now have to start to try to put together the sanctions again. I think there's been damage done here. There's been some damage done, I think, to the alliance, particularly with South Korea, who was blindsided by this. I think more importantly, it's been damage done to the maximum pressure campaign, because we took the pressure off.
Yeah.
We took the pressure off without knowing with enough confidence that we could have a successful negotiation. So there's been damage done here, I think, through the process that we've undertaken here.
Final thing I wanted to talk to you about. The president, one of the real targets for him during the campaign was China, that China was taking advantage. Yeah. He was going to get tough with China. You've spent a great deal of time there, both as a diplomat and in your business career. Tell me where you think we are, because it feels like far from being disadvantaged by the president's policies, China has been blessed with a gift.
Yeah, a couple of things. First of all, China is in a very confident mode right now. President Xi Jinping has been selected now to be the leader of China without limit, with the change in their in their constitution, and he's a very powerful leader of China. People say in a cliche that he's the most powerful leader of China since Mao. In truth, in terms of the presence on the world stage, more powerful, because the China that Mao led is not the China that Xi Jinping leads today. It's an entirely different country, with much more impact on the world's economy and geopolitics, the first point. Second is that there's a strategic set of conversations that need to be had here, I think, and insights to be gained with respect to this new competitive phase that we're in vis-a-vis China. It's not the same as Russia. I think on Russia, we're actually in an actively hostile mode with the Russians. But it is a more competitive phase with China as it becomes a bigger player on the world scene. Third is that as a result, whether Hillary Clinton got elected president or Donald Trump got elected president, we were going to have to deal with address a number of these structural economic issues between the United States and China, including their subsidies and the way they are pursuing their technological agenda things. We were going to have to
stealing intellectual property.
These were going to have to be addressed by whoever was the president.
Right.
What I fear is this. Is that the president's focus on the bilateral trade deficit, which is the function of a lot of other things, including your investment level and savings level in your country. I fear that we're going to make smaller deals on that, right, and not deal with really some of the fundamental issues that are facing the United States and China over the long haul. And we actually had an approach, which I think would have been better for the Trump administration to pursue, which is a multilateral approach to deal with these structural issues. The TPP was exactly geared, right, to set the rules of the game on trade in the world. And at some point along the way here of history, China was going to have to move to those rules of the game if they wanted to participate in global trade. We had under negotiation a bilateral investment treaty, which was to go to the very concept of reciprocity. That is, our companies need to be treated in your country the way we treat your companies in our country. And that's been pushed to the side as well. And third, of course, we decided to do this bilaterally as opposed to kind of multilaterally with the Europeans and others, where we could have had a much more constructive conversation and I think more effectiveness in terms of dealing with China. So my fear is that this bilateral focus on deals and focus on numbers and the bilateral trade deficit, I hope, my fear is though, it will distract us from not allow us to deal, David, with what are really important structural issues going forward here in terms of the U.S.-China relationship.
And presumably this sort of withdrawal of leadership that you spoke about earlier leaves an enormous opportunity for the Chinese, who are making investments all over the world, their Belt and Road program, and who are playing a very aggressive game.
Yeah, and again, it's at multiple levels. It's economic, it's geopolitical. The Chinese clearly have, tried to push to have a sphere of influence in the region. So it's very important for us to reinforce our alliances. It's also really important for us to continue to be the leader of the free world, as we said, you know, in the past, right? A values leader, because there's an alternative model on offer. You know, it's interesting. If you spend time in China today, and it isn't the theory that many people had for many years was that as China became richer, it would move towards a liberal Western democratic approach, and would adopt the principles and approaches of the Western liberal democracies. That is not what's going on in China today. China has made a set of different decisions, and they're quite clear about it. They expressly reject a number of the approaches and the principles and pillars of our approach in kind of Western liberal democracies, and they have much more a top-down, one-party-led system, and that's the offer that they're making, right? Mm-hmm. Their approach is
they're making the case that authoritarianism is a more effective way to achieve your national objectives
for your people
in the modern world.
Yeah, right. And that's the contest we're in, right? So that ideological contest, where the United States has historically been the leader to great effect, is one that we can't step back from. And that's what I fear we're stepping back from. And this goes to a thing I know we have to finish up, is on the issue of democracy.
Mm-hmm.
Where if you look at the polling data today, David, you have increasing numbers, particularly of younger people, who don't see democracy as essential to the way to run a government, right? That's very dangerous, I think, for us going forward. You know, there's a crisis of governance in the Western democracies. And, you know, Frank Fukuyama wrote a famous book in 1989 called The End of History,
yes,
where his proposition was that we had found the best way to run governments. And it is kind of, you know, the liberal economic democratic order. And that was going to win out, and all the rest were going to get swept to the side. He turned out to be wrong. You know, there were two other great books written around that same time period, one by Sam Huntington called The Clash of Civilizations, one written by the famous John Mersheimer at the University
right
of Chicago
here, yes,
on the tragedy of great powers, which saw a much more complicated competitive world. That feels like the world we're in, and we need to lead on these democratic propositions. I think you need a leader to say, I am going to lead the free world. I think we need better civic education in the United States. We need critical thinking education in the United States. We need to defend ourselves against these attacks. So there's a lot to be done here in order to kind of really have the United States thrive, and I think it can, in this new competitive phase.
We will see where we're... I have a feeling we're going to be having more of these conversations in the years to come. They may not go where we want it to go as a country, but they're going to be interesting for sure. Tom Dolan, great to be with you, as always. And thank you for being at the Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago.
Thank you, David.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, part of the CNN Podcast Network. For more episodes of The Axe Files, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. For more programming from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.